I think we're live. Welcome, Madtropolis. Welcome to Mad Gains Live. I'm Cassandra Gaines, and I have a very special treat for my entrepreneurs today. I am bringing you a CEO who understands our industry, who has built a company from beginning all the way to success, and we're going to pick his brain today, get to know his product, and you guys will be able to learn. I know that there are people out there who are new to Mad Gains, and I keep forgetting that we've got new people, and we get them every day, all day. So for those of you out there who are new, Mad Gains and the followers, which we all call each other citizens of Madtropolis, we're here to unite the industry. We're here to unite by having a live forum and education for shippers, brokers, and carriers, and anyone who supports those groups as well. So we're excited to have you guys here. Make sure that you subscribe on YouTube. Make sure you follow me on LinkedIn. And also, know that you will see on YouTube and on LinkedIn when you're in the live chat that there will be moderators. You'll have Amanda Miller, you'll have Chris Jolly, Chandler, V, Ron Kane, and they're the ones who will keep the discussions going. And if you have questions, go ahead and ask them any questions you have. So for today, I have brought you a CEO, and this episode is for my entrepreneurs because we're all hitting a time frame where those of us who started up new businesses and new ideas or trying to grow their businesses, we're midway through 2020 and we need an upper. And Jet is your upper. So welcome, Jet, from Project 44. I almost called it Carrier 44, but Project 44. Whatever does that name mean, by the way, Jet?
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on, and really humbled for the other list of guests you've had, so thanks. Project 44 started as a U.S. company. We're global now. We operate in 116 countries, but Route 66 that ran from Chicago to L.A., which, as you know, is a major corridor, it was replaced by Highway 44. More modern infrastructure, many more trucks could be processed through the road. And when they built Highway 44, it was called Project 44. So we thought we're replacing the old legacy methods and manual processes. So why don't we name ourselves after that project?
It's very clever too. For those of you, and I just want to make sure that I am making sure I'm encouraging everybody to go head on over to YouTube. And I'm going to watch the chat on YouTube, and we have moderators there as well. And I'm going to watch the chat there on LinkedIn. I see Amanda Miller is already in LinkedIn, and Steve Perez and Jason Chandler. So thanks for joining us, everybody. So here are my two goals with bringing you guys Jet.
All right.
I wrote them down because this week's been so busy for Madtropolis. So nice. My first goal is to bring my entrepreneurs some encouragement. And then My second goal is for those who remember the interview recently with Justin Hall, And he works for a VC. And many people ask the question, well, can you name some of the VC-funded companies that are considered a success? And I decided, let's do a follow-up. Let's bring Jet on. He's a little bit of a different type of VC company, but he is the definition of a success, according to Cassandra Gaines, by the way. But before we get started, I thought I would get back to my roots. Jet, this is my game music.
I love it. Let's do it.
Jet, you're going to play a game today. You're being blindsided by this game for everybody who knows. I want to get back to my roots, which are my games. I've been getting away from them lately. And here's what this game is. It's called Never Have I Ever.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
So I'm going to ask you a series of questions that may be inappropriate, and you're going to answer, I have, or I have never.
Yeah.
So we'll go with an easy one. Jet, have you ever gone dumpster diving?
Yes, I have.
Was it in college?
High school. Definitely high school. It was high school.
High school? Okay.
Yes.
I always love asking that question because some people are like, dumpster diving? What the heck is that? And I'm like, man, if you haven't done that in college, you missed out on some golden stuff.
That's great. That's
so, here's your other question.
It's been a while.
It's been a while. All right, Jets, let's get a little harder. Jet, never have I ever have you gotten a tattoo that later you regretted?
I've not got a tattoo ever because I don't want to. Yeah, zero, none.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a bit boring, I know.
That's all right. That's all right. All right, got a random one for you.
All right.
Have you ever been bitten by a snake?
Not literally, but definitely in business.
I have to. And for those of you out there who are listening, if anybody's been bit by a snake, can you please put it in the comments? I want to hear that story. Yes, literally in business. All right, Jet, you have two more questions and you're out of the hot seat.
All right.
Have you ever given someone a fake name?
Definitely, 100%.
What was the name?
Oh, there's so many. Typically, I'm not Jet. I'm usually Jeff or John or Chet or anything. So oftentimes, of course, I go with it. But yeah, just for the sake of ease, for sure. Okay. Definitely giving fake names.
Is anybody in the comments, can you please tell me what your fake names are or your names on your IDs when you're pretending that you're 21? Last question.
That's right.
And then you're off the hot seat. This is making him very nervous, I'm sure. He did this to Doug Wagner. And we did not take it easy on him. God bless that man. So your last question is, have you ever been kicked out of a bar?
Yes, 100%.
I think most of us can probably say yes to that.
I think there should be some of the qualifying questions on whether or not who you have on the show.
I think so too. In fact, our famous shipper called the Freight Godfather, Ron Kane. If anybody wants to watch some of my old YouTube videos, he's very famous for getting kicked out of a bar and refusing to tell us the story. So we want to hear what that is. All right, so we'll dive in. So Jet, you're going to go first. If you will give us, we're all extremely curious about this history you have in our industry. From dispatcher to CEO is the way we titled it. But we'd love to hear about your history and then how you ended up here.
Sure. Love to walk through the story. So let's rewind time. It's 1999. I'm in Portland, Oregon, and working at Wells Fargo as a temp, trying to pay for college, just broke as hell. Not many years after dumpster diving and trying to pay the bills. And I look around Wells Fargo and that movie Office Space that had been on the movies back then. Yeah, great movie. They kept moving my desk often. If you remember the guy with the red stapler. And I realized, like, hey, listen, I'm a C-minus student, C student. Everyone else is an MBA, and they're like A-plus students. Like, I'm never going to go anywhere here. And so I start looking at other jobs, other gigs. And there's a company, Roadway Express, $15 an hour. Come check it out. So it's $2 more an hour. And so I jumped on it. It was an awesome experience. Roadway was a good brand back then. Just every operations job at Roadway ended up moving down to Phoenix, where you are.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to dry out from Portland, get a little sun. And back then, I didn't really have access to the internet. And even at Roadway, it was AS400 green screens. And nice. So I checked the paper and I said, this Phoenix place looks sunny. I couldn't afford to visit. So I just packed my stuff up and moved in a car. And worked down at Yellow on, I think that's 43rd Avenue in Lower Buckeye.
Mm-hmm.
We're working graveyard shift. And every ops position, local sales, national sales. And there's this little small startup in town called Global Trans. They had about 7 employees. Maybe $1 million in revenue. And I ended up joining those folks. And that was a hell of a ride.
Was that your first time in logistics?
Well, I guess you'd say on the non-asset side for sure. That's what I wanted to learn. I said, why don't I just take I didn't think there was much left to accomplish on the asset carrier side other than the management. I'd managed Walmart at YRC. It was a $1 billion account. There just wasn't much left else to accomplish, I thought. And Global Trans seemed like an interesting challenge, and it was in a lot of different ways. So joined Global Trans. That was a fun ride from just a couple million bucks all the way to 100 million in revenue. And I wasn't quite an entrepreneur there, right? As part of the founding team is probably the correct way to say it.
Mm-hmm.
And then started my own consulting firm in Project 44 afterwards.
Simultaneously? Or consulting, then Project 44?
Consulting. Global Trans is very litigious as being general counsel there, you may remember.
Yes.
And they were very interested in enforcing my non-compete. So the only thing I could do was consult for trucking companies at the time, hence the name Carrier Direct. And that's where I started that. But when you're consulting, you're trading time for money.
For sure.
And I wanted to get more leverage out of my time. And I saw, as a consultant, I'd go to Global Trans or other 3PLs, other carriers. And what I saw was this real need. There was this problem in the industry where there was information asymmetry, essentially, that the dispatcher had different information than the driver and the carrier and the shipper, the consignee. It just kind of drove me nuts. I love solving problems. And I thought, well, what if there was a technology platform that could create information symmetry across all the folks?
And so with Project 44, I remember when I first learned about it, I was like, what the heck is this company? And at the time, most integration, if a broker actually integrated with carriers, it was usually LTL and it was usually via EDI. I think you were one of the first companies to have API integration. Is that right? Or am I just a dumb lawyer?
I think you're pretty spot on. There were a few other folks that had web scraping and maybe a few APIs, but I just saw it as being a larger scale. The problem with EDI is that it's not synchronous, meaning that the connection is sent from one party to the other, and the other party can't tell if the other group got it unless you set up another asynchronous connection to say, hey, I've received it, which very few companies do because it's expensive and takes a lot of time. And then there's obviously a lot of limited data fields. And the other thing is you can't repeat. So it's called a many-to-many. So every time you set up a new carrier, you have to set up that new carrier again and again and again. With APIs, you could set up a carrier once and it could be reused by all your other customers. To me, it just made a lot of sense. When you deal with like some companies you worked at, they're doing business with tens of thousands of carriers. It just kind of makes sense. Well, what if one company was to aggregate all the carriers and make it available for the next customer and the next customer, and every new customer would make it that much more powerful for the following customer. So that was really my attraction to it.
So with shippers and brokers, are they using Project 44 as a, they get visibility. So they use it as another app that they open up or they have it in their screen if they're like carrier sales or something in a brokerage and they can see everything? Is it just visibility or can they do more?
Yes, so they could do more with Project 44. We tend to go to market with advanced visibility. It's kind of the idea, and it's more than just visibility and tracking, as you would say. I'd say early on where I got the business model wrong is I didn't think that the industry needed another application. I thought, let's just have something like data as a service or infrastructure as a service, depending on what you want to call it, where we could be that connective tissue and connect the existing TMS or WMS into the carriers. And we really struggled to get it out. We had decent numbers. We had just good enough numbers to be able to fundraise with. But most of the business users, really on the shipper side at that time, didn't understand what we were doing. Mm-hmm. And so we ended up, I'd say a pivot into building an application on top of that data as a service that we had. And I think that's one of the things that differentiates us because we have higher quality data. So there's an application and there is a product which is data as a service. And I'd say from a revenue standpoint, it's probably a 70-30 split.
Makes sense. So when you started, okay, I have people, I'm sure they do the same thing to you, that come to me with these tech ideas and they're not in tech. They don't understand tech, but they'll be like, this is what the industry needs, this, this, and this. I'm going to start this company. Was that you back in the day when you started it? Were you coming up with this idea and you had to go out and find like a software engineer and you had to find investment and you had to get people to buy into your idea, or how did you go about it?
That's right. I'd say, so I definitely was not a technologist at the time, always a bit fascinated by it. But you know, when I went to high school in the 90s, tech was not as cool as it is now, let's just say. And the people that really, if you look at the innovation bell curve, it was that first movers and the innovators that were really kind of involved with it. I mean, when I was in high school, there was still a typing class. I don't know if they have that anymore in high school. But so it's just kind of like something you kind of did. At Global Trans, we had a lot of proprietary technology, and we outsourced it to India. And we would have folks from India come over for 3 months at a time on a visa. And I just took the opportunity, you know, living in Scottsdale, you know, the environment's kind of kind of a fun environment to be single in. But I said, you know, if I make some sacrifices now, what's the possibility? So I'd have the folks when they came from India live with me, and I'd take them like the first haircut, like all these other first experiences that Scottsdale has to offer. And like a female haircut, that's, I guess it was a bit unusual for them culturally. And then, and we would, I would just on the way to work, on the way home from work, and at night at dinner, I would just try to pick up as much as I could about how technology worked. And I think I just started to realize you could really build anything with technology. It just comes down to, you know, do you have a strong enough technical partner, and do you have enough capital? Pretty much everything's possible, especially in logistics. There's not much that's tip of the spear that we're doing. Most of it's just borrowed ideas that are
so true. Oh my God, I was just talking about that with someone, and it's interesting the companies that are repackaging things that have existed in our industry for a while. I think you tell me, but I think that whether an idea is a good idea, whether it works, it's all about, or new idea, it's all about getting people to actually use it from all different platforms, from a carrier, from a shipper to a broker. And I'm sure you experienced the pains of this growing Project 44, is getting people to actually understand your product and then using the product.
Yeah, that's right. We call it a cold start problem. We're a multi-level network business, which are the most difficult businesses to build. And so when you talk about that ecosystem that you are, oftentimes that can be the toughest thing. How do you get the flywheel to start to spin? And so you have to, there's some great articles out there about it, but you typically think about it as supply and demand. And although we're not a marketplace, and so those words may seem a bit odd to users using that context. The supply side would be carriers, whether it's asset or non-asset. And then on the demand side would be the shipper. And you have to think about what's the value you can create for each party. Does one party have enough leverage over the other party to force usage of the product?
That's always what I'm thinking about too. How was the sell to shippers? Because you were early out of the gate. That's why I kept an eye. I'm lucky. I got to work with Doug Wagner for a couple of years, and he's always very curious. So he's always keeping up on tech, and he's keeping an eye on things all the time. And so I was lucky that I had exposure to your company early as well. But you're early out of the gate for the product that you were issuing. And so how did you get shippers to at least buy in? Because I have a lot of shippers that follow us, and sometimes in their departments, they don't get a lot of funding. They don't get a lot of resources. They're overworked. And sometimes just having to work with another company with another app is like not all that appealing.
Yeah, that's true. We started out selling to 3PLs. So Doug, Echo, Agree, progressive guy, great brand. And I'd say Doug's an early adopter. It may even be as far left as an innovator when we think about the innovation bell curve. We knew that, at least we thought that at the time, that if we could provide value to 3PLs to communicate with their carriers, who were very price sensitive, I'd probably say even fickle, that we could probably, it'd be a change of motion and go to market and different value prop. But if the ROI was there for the 3PLs, we tend to be experts in the equation that we could retool the go-to-market to sell to shippers. And that motion is quite a bit different. But for us, it really just comes down to what's the ROI. We had a nice tailwind with the Amazon experience also. It was what we would call the delivery economy, that companies are no longer valued or judged just off the product. It's the product and the logistics experience. And so that Amazon tailwind, Amazon effect was big. And then, of course, we have COVID, which was a huge, now it's a huge, huge tailwind for us. Companies realize they need to modernize and digitalize their supply chain and their logistics.
It's crazy how it took COVID to figure that out, but and it's tough. I talk about this often with guests from Madtropolis. It's hard to get everybody to use, everybody's going to roll their eyes when I say this, but electronic bill ladings drives me nuts. We still use paper. We're still printing things out. And so I'm always trying to figure out how can we get everybody to use the same products, so we're not using antiquated processes. So are you guys able to get truckload carriers to use a product, or are you purchasing maybe the ELD data?
ELD, yeah. Yeah, for us, so we've had e-billing for almost 5 years now, so quite a long time.
Nice, nice.
To your point, it wasn't for LTL. We've had it for truckload for a while also. And I guess I would say some of the LTL carriers do truckload with it, but when you think about the core truckload carriers, that's taken a little longer. So we try to meet the market where it is, to try to have this idea that all these carriers are going to come to our platform or another platform, and be able to get their tech that's in various different systems and AS400s and different versions and things they may be, platforms they may be retiring. It didn't make sense for us to try to get them to conform to our standards. We just thought, where can we meet the market where it is? So to your example that you provided for the ELDs, there's about 700 different ELD providers we're connected to globally across those 116 countries. So we were able to digest all that information from whatever hardware they elect to use.
Makes sense. It's interesting. I'll leave that alone. It drives me nuts sometimes. So it's good hearing this. So let's go back to your journey, because I can see that that's what a lot of people like to hear about in the comments as well. Which is, did you have to get investing right away? Were you a VC? Did you have private equity or VC funding or an investor?
Did you start this
off grassroots?
Yeah, it was the institutional investors, we call it a bootstrap company. Mm-hmm. So I used investment capital, save money through various things. I'd had some, I'd say like some stand-up singles, maybe some stand-up doubles through my career, and various ways inside the industry and outside of the industry, and used basically all the capital that had accumulated to start Project 44. And, you know, it got pretty tight. I was fortunate enough that I had a small two-bedroom place I paid off in Chicago, and I had the title to it. And I remember once we couldn't make payroll right towards the end before we took institutional. And I was literally going bank to bank around Chicago trying to figure out, who would take the title of my house and give me a loan on it. Surprisingly, it wasn't that easy. But then we ended up taking institutional capital. I think the first round was about $10 million is what the first round was. It was probably about 2 years into the company.
What's your advice to an entrepreneur who is trying to build a business grassroots, trying to also find funding, but balancing the concern of finances and the future success of the business with the current success that's being seen, if that makes sense, when you're trying to make a decision on whether, do I keep going and I'm running out of cash and there's not as much revenue coming in the door? I know this is a great idea. Do I keep going? Do I keep pushing? Or when do I call it quits?
Yeah, I think so. This is a huge industry that just has a lot of opportunity for improvements. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes folks, and I've been guilty of this also, have tried to build tech solutions for a TAM, a total addressable market, that's just too small. And if you want institutional capital, you have to make sure there's a really large TAM. You have to understand how venture capital works. I thought Justin Hall did a good job of explaining venture capital, very risk, they have a high risk profile that they're willing to take a look at. They only need 3 out of 10 investments to play big, but all 10 investments have to have a massive TAM. I don't mean just the industry, I mean the solution that the software, the product's gonna solve. So that's like step one, like, is the TAM there? And then you have to realize, like, is there product market fit? So if you're running out of cash, you're not sure what to do, you just have to be honest with yourself. Like, is there product market fit? For myself, when we were getting low on cash, we were having a tough time out in the market. I was frustrated because I couldn't get shippers to understand that data as a service was the solution. Plug it into existing TMS, CRM, WMS, something you've already invested in. And then I remember, I don't remember who said it, but it's, basically said, like, if you're frustrated people aren't buying your product, you either have a shitty product or you're doing a bad job messaging it, or you don't have product market fit. So that kind of, I kind of looked at all those and I go, I might be right in all situations. So how can we adjust to to actually make sure the company is successful.
So how did you?
For us, we started an application. We changed our go-to-market, our early marketing. We really tried to go EDI versus API. We thought that was the way because API is by far superior. We just burn way too much cash trying to educate the market on that.
Yep.
Rather than just talk about what's the real value or what problem that can we help you solve? So two things that happened: the application and then that marketing. Then the motion of what we were trying to talk to the market about.
So when you finally when was your next round of investments? And then what were they looking for in your company? For those who are new to the VC PE world, what did you have to pitch and show to get investment?
So for seed or series A, and I guess if someone's really serious about it, it does matter as to some of this naming, and it's worth it to go through and actually figure out what some of these names mean. Seed, series A, series B. They are kind of loosely thrown around, but they do tend to matter more than I think most people think. Just to do the seed or that first institutional capital, you need a TAM, you need a team that they believe in, and the idea that you'll be able to build something that can be used. That's about really all you need. If you have a product and you have product market fit and you have revenue and customers, those are all big pluses. Mm-hmm. You get into the next stage, and it's basically you don't have your unit economics baked, or you can't show clearly what the unit economics are. You have some product market fit, and there's this idea that more capital would allow you to be a little bit more successful. And then you have the next round, which is Series B for most firms, which is, all right, let's harden the unit economics here. Let's find out what the return is. They start talking about things like CAC, cost to acquire customer, LTV, lifetime value of customer, logo retention, net retention. These are things that start to come into play a little bit more in Series B, Series C. And after that, the letters don't matter as much. It's really just growth. And for growth to get that far, you really have to have fully baked unit economics that makes sense to the investors when they drop your...
Do they fully focus on just revenue?
No, not at all.
A lot of CEOs who have VC funding or PE backing, they'll be like, oh, I'm going to hit $5 million in revenue. And I'm always thinking well, why is that a goal? Shouldn't you be thinking about how much you're bleeding in the back end?
Yeah, it probably depends on what it is. I thought you and Justin Hall had a good debate going. And I think it's important to say, what's the difference between a marketplace or a tech-enabled broker? And what's the difference between a SaaS company? And those are two different things, and they get graded and judged by different VCs. In fact, some VCs are only interested in one business model, not the other.
Interesting.
You have to be really...
Why is that?
Well, they just specialize. Like the firm that led my Series A, Emergence, they only make investment in SaaS companies. So Zoom, who we're on now, they were the early investor with Zoom. Salesforce, they were early with, and a handful of other groups. They just specialize in that. They like the motion. They're world class at it. They understand how to build the product. So that's what they like. There are other VC firms that are larger that have more appetite for a wider range of business models. But I agree with you that some of these other podcasts, that if it's a tech-enabled brokerage and you're just looking at gross revenue, that's not really a sustainable business. There is some density and economies of scale that could happen through it, but that in itself isn't that interesting to me. When you get into SaaS, revenue matters, net retention matters a lot, cost to acquire customer, something else called magic number that's a big deal right now, and then LTV. Those are kind of the big ones.
What I see a question here that's quite interesting. Is when will the market see artificial intelligence? Oh no, let's wait on that one. There was another really good question that had to do with calculating. How do you calculate, by any chance, do you know, how you calculate the lifetime value for a client, for a customer? And it's okay if you don't know the answer, that's pretty intense.
Yeah, so lifetime value is, I'll have to Google the exact ways, and I have way smarter people that that have it. So let's just take a look at LTV, SAS. Let's make sure we get it right.
A lot of good questions coming in. I'm going to write them down real quick.
So lifetime value is estimated of average gross revenue that a customer generates before they churn. So this is where, so for us, our churn is less than 1% and our net retention is over 120%. So
what does that mean again? I love that you looked that up, by the way, because that's exactly what I would have done.
Yeah, it's just that. So churn is just how many customers are leaving you. So when we think like brokerage and carriers, it's markets probably, I don't know what it is right now. It's been a few years, but it's usually somewhere between 25 and 40% churn. So it just means that for every dollar that you take in this year, that same dollar from that same logo, you're going to have 25 to 40% less. So that logo itself could have generate that much less, or that, or you could just have, that logo could completely disappear. So you kind of leave it as like, what's going in the front door, what's going out the back door. So, with SaaS, with a company like us, if you do a good job and you can keep your logos from churning, and we've had bumps in the road and, we're always trying to get better, and we've been really, really fortunate by the customers we've had and the loyalty they've had to us. If you have less than 1% of your customers churning, then and that's really helpful for what the net retention is, for what the revenue that you're going to build off for the following year. So it's a lot. If you have to replace 40% of your revenue every year in your business, it's quite expensive.
This is interesting.
Lifetime value is, so let's say we when you're as new a company as we are, it's a bit of an estimate as to what the lifetime value would be. Mm-hmm. But if not many customers are leaving, then you could say, well, it's likely that we could model this out, that a lifetime value of a customer that would retain them for 5 years. And so
right.
You could start.
That's the first thing I was saying is I would bucket them if I could. I don't know if that's what they do, but I'd be like, all right, here are the amount of customers that I have that could be 1 to 2 years. They'll stay with us 5 to 8, 8 to 15.
Yep.
I don't know if that's what they really do. I'm just making the shit up, but.
So as they were the contracts themselves, what's the length of the contracts?
Yeah. Long-term contracts. Yeah. That would be good too. Are you doing anything with the data? It feels like you would have a lot of data coming and going. Are you allowed to do anything else with that? Or do you have any analytics and it's okay if you're not allowed to talk about that either. That wasn't on the list.
We can talk about anything.
We can talk about anything.
And anything we want. Let's get the questions out. I made a mistake early on lifetime value sorry about the lake house. I have family here and
that's all right, we like it.
A lot of people running around.
Justin had people coming and going in the background and like kids waving and stuff. For all of us who are ADD, we love that stuff.
Yeah. With the data. So, I made a mistake early on that I wouldn't sign contracts with customers that wouldn't allow us to use the data. Because I thought, the real value is what kind of predictive and prescriptive analytics can you build? You know, when I looked at your attendee list and folks that you have joined a lot of these calls, and it looked like some really world-class folks from some amazing brands. And those folks realize that there's a real tribal knowledge they bring to the table every day for what they do in their job function. And some of it's a bit repetitive and they're probably annoyed with it. And they probably sit back, like I was when I was a broker or 3PL or Karen, I thought, man, there's way cooler, smarter things I could be doing. But it's tough to... some of us just needs basic analytics so everyone can have the same, be on the same baseline, essentially. It's an employee at one of these companies. And we had a lot of customers say no early on, like, hey, we're not going to do a deal with you. And then I just thought, let's just make this simple. If you opt in to share the data, then we can you can buy our analytics products. If you opt out, then you can't buy the analytics mm-hmm. product. And what we quickly saw is that companies that were opting in to buy the analytics products were just destroying their competitors. They have such a competitive advantage over it. And so the problem kind of took care of itself.
That's smart. Because that is, I was playing dumb lawyer, but when you were first starting out, I thought you would go more the direction, actually, that FreightWaves is gone with Sonar.
Yeah.
I thought that was more where you were going to go, except for not saying that you shouldn't. It's like I've seen your platform. In fact, you want to know what's funny is I have like happy hours of friends. And I told them you were going to be on. And we did, they shared, one of my friends shared his screen so I could see exactly how he uses your tool.
Nice.
And I figured you wouldn't mind since I was going to use it for the show that he shared it. But I mean, Project 44 is not paying me crap for this. I don't owe you guys anything. It's a good tool.
Thank you.
Really nice. And so you've definitely gone the right direction with this.
I appreciate it.
With this product. So right now, so who's your largest customer? Is it brokers?
Amazon's our largest single customer.
Okay. And are they integrating or are they just everybody's pulling it up as another?
Yeah, for them, they use it data as a service. So being a pretty progressive company, and a lot of the brokers use it as data as a service, where a lot of the shippers use the application.
Data as a service means that you give them analytics? Is that what that is?
It can include analytics. It basically means that they have a software application that we're sending data into.
Okay.
It could be just the raw data. It could be analytics also. It's an integration, and they're surfacing it. They're looking at the technology, at the data to an application. It's not ours. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Should I go over that again?
Okay. No, I was imagining it out and now.
Okay.
So they have their own TMS and they can see the data that you're feeding.
That's right.
Right in their own TMS, which is nice.
And it tends to, at this, you know, as we sit in July of 2020, it's oftentimes it's bigger than a TMS. It's a control tower. It's a CRM, it's a WMS, it's an ERP. It's really all those existing systems of record, system of engagement. They all benefit from supply chain information. So how can they make better business decisions? The TMS tends to be so siloed into just the transport team at a shipper. When you talk about a 3PL, of course, pretty much every seat has access to TMS.
Yeah. Okay, so actually, this is a good question from Scott. What's the advantage for a carrier to use Project 44? Make sure we should define carrier, because you've got your LTLs, which is kind of given. But then most of us that follow this show, we're in the truckload world, most of us.
Yeah.
Who are brokers or carriers are in the truckload world.
And most
shippers
of the
are all over.
Mostly domestic also, right? So there are some different advantages.
I have a lot in Canada.
So for North America, it's pretty much the same value prop. So for carriers, there's a number of things. I think FedEx is a company we would all respect. They always show the logo is amazing. It's always clean. The trucks are always clean. Everything's always showing up, whether it's FedEx Express or Parcel. And you know, being a $50 billion company, they had a lot of concerns internally as to, you know, should they allow someone like Project 44 to connect to their data. You know, I don't remember if you remember the movie Castaway.
Yeah.
Anytime there's a FedEx logo in a movie or anything, they always have people on site because they want to protect the logo. Mm-hmm. And if remember Castaway, and the FedEx boxes rolled up, they're all in perfect condition.
Yeah.
As the airplane explodes, they floated 10 okay. miles, but they're perfect, which I respect. I really, really, truly respect that. So it's an interesting brand, and I'll explain the parallels between truckload. But at the end of the day, carriers have a low ROIC, at least most of them. And so return on investment capital. And I have a lot of empathy for carriers. So when I built Project 44, you know, I spent more time at a carrier than I did as a 3PL and more time than I did as a technologist. They have to worry about engines and transmissions and trailers and labor laws and lawsuits. And
it's unreal.
It's like, you look at the list of things that they're burdened with. It's incredible. Mm-hmm. And so I've always had a soft spot for working graveyard. I mean, I worked graveyard at a carrier for many, many years. And they're some of the best people, hardest working people. So I said, if I'm going to build a tech company, I want it to empower. I want it to make a carrier's life easier. So for the example you're asking for with truckload here, anytime there's automation to the carrier, anytime that there's more notice to a carrier, that helps the carrier. It either helps them with better planning, more efficient routing. They can provide better stability to their drivers and have less turnover, less phone calls, less emails. The list goes on and on. But anytime there's automation to a carrier where information is just pushed directly into their system, lowers their cost. And there are also other features that help them improve their revenue. So when a carrier logs on to Project 44, system, which we never charge the carrier for, because again, a lot of empathy for the carriers and the hard work they do. They can log on, they can see all 300 of our customers, and maybe they only do business with two of them. They can just go, I want to expose my trucks to the other, 300 plus companies, and they can start to get more revenue from those for that.
Can they
in an automated fashion also.
Mm-hmm. Can they select the time, or is it flat out opt-in anywhere I go? I'm assuming this is a phone app. You know my data.
It's not a phone app. It is a desktop app.
Okay.
It's not like a marketplace or anything like that. It's just really more of say, hey, we're already connected on the Project 44 platform. We did the connection once. Now all these other customers of Project 44, you could see that there's an automation here. You don't have to call us. You don't have to email us. You don't have to set up EDI. You don't have to set up an integration. All the connectivity is already done. And so the shippers then will call, or the 3PLs, either one, will call the carrier and say, hey, this is great that you're already connected. They know that they're going to have a better experience and it's a lower cost of doing business.
Right. But a couple of our famous drivers on Madtropolis, Ingrid being one of them, she often talks about how it does make her very nervous. And this argument has been around for over 10 years, where there's a trade-off with these carriers opting in and giving location data, and then the carriers who don't want all that data given to a third party 100% of the time. Have you guys found a solution to that argument, or is that something that people kind of, it's just a trade-off like every other company? We know where you are. It's your data.
Yeah. I don't really subscribe to the latter. And again, maybe it's because I was a dispatcher for many, many years, and I know drivers work hard. And I think it is probably important to bucket carriers into different sizes, because depending on their size and again, geography of the world, there could be slightly different answers here. So if you're talking with a small carrier that doesn't want us to connect to the ELD, if you look at our app on iTunes or anywhere, it's incredibly simple. And like, it is purposely really big icon, like we are tracking you or we are not tracking you. And we just try to make it as simple as possible. We don't play any games with it at all. Now, if drivers want some additional advantages that are location driven, like we're having in the future, like do you want to know where a shower nearby is available or parking spots nearby that's available? Naturally, that's more valuable if the location service is turned on. But we don't have that currently. So it's just really big, like tracking before, tracking after. And we're really upfront. Like we track 90 minutes before the truck arrives and 90 minutes after the truck.
Oh, okay. So it's not just, we know where you are 24/7. You're shopping at the grocery store. We got you.
Yeah, it's not really our thing. And, you know, in Europe, you're not allowed to do that because of GDPR. And in fact, we have such good gates as to how well data is secured. A lot of carriers use us in Europe to track their own drivers. Because they don't have the technology to be GDPR compliant. And so we have that same software in the US. We naturally don't market it the same way, but it does give the drivers a lot more privacy even in the US because of the way the system is designed.
So we have 15 more minutes, and I want to spin off to a question that I know that a lot of people are going to want to talk about, which is where, first we can talk about where the opportunities that you see in the industry right now. Talk about the industry as a whole, and then maybe we'll wrap up by talking about where's Project 44 going for the rest of the year, what's in your pipeline, things like that. So a lot of questions in the feed talked about where do you see opportunities? Like if you had a magic wand, you had unlimited amounts of money and you can invest in anything, where do you see the opportunities in our industry now?
Yeah, it's a good question. I need to really kind of zoom out from the day-to-day of what I focus on. I think it's not a surprise that digital and automation is going to be a continued growing trend. So I'd say anywhere where there's a cost reduction. That said, the value prop has to be greater than just cost reduction. One thing I've noticed, and we saw it in 2009, we're seeing it again with COVID, cost savings. Companies aren't willing to spend money just to save money.
It's unreal. When times
are tough, they just can't get the CapEx approved. And I think it's because a lot of projects that folks sponsored often don't have the ROI that are talked about. So that's not like transportation specific, it's just more broad across any organization. So think that's why they pull back that CapEx, what happens. I'd say anything in logistics, it's automation, digitalization, that has a value prop, has an ROI and something greater than ROI. And I'll leave it really broad because I don't want to like pollute anyone's mind on like a specific idea. It's so massive and it's so incredibly inefficient. I see startups all the time where I'm just like, oh, that's a brilliant idea. Like there must be hundreds of amazing startups out there right now. Like yeah. They're truly impressive.
You want to know what's weird, Jet, is that back in 2014, maybe 2013, I started hearing the Uber freight term. Actually, I feel was so, do you remember 10-4?
Yeah, I remember 10-4.
So it felt like that was a kind of a leading company at the time with the, it didn't work out, I don't think, but that was when I started hearing the Uber freight and the digital freight broker term.
Yeah.
But, you know, years later, we sit here. Do you think we truly have a digital freight broker out there? And by the way, what do you think that means? Because I'm a dumb lawyer and I get a different answer from everybody what the hell that even means. Because most brokers are digital. They're investing in software and they're trying to do as much as they can. So I'm confused.
Yeah, I think the industry, let's take a pause here. Carriers have so much to invest in. Like let's actually just look at history here. We talked about earlier, the trucks and transmissions and maintenance and systems and sales reps. Sure, it just goes on and on and on and on and on. And they tend to really want to delight their customers, but it's probably not a core competency. So if we think about like what happened, that created an opportunity for 3PLs to exist and be a bit of more of like a customer service, a better experience for the shippers. And on top of that, provide multiple options. Well, it didn't take long for the 3PLs to realize, hey, let's just put together some basic tech and create some efficiencies here. So to your point, most of these 3PLs early on had some type of digital tool, some type of technology. There was a lot of innovation that happened. We think about like Coyote was like Echo, Coyote, a lot of other great brands, brands that don't even get credit like Schneider, JB Hunt, like these guys also invested a lot in
yeah,
tech.
Yeah, for sure.
But there was this kind of missed opportunity for Uber for freight. It wasn't just transportation logistics where it was like Uber for everything. I mean, this was like, there's like Uber for haircuts and like Uber for massage. And it's like everything like wanted to hijack this word.
That's true.
As you think about the innovation bell curve, as it got to the late majority, basically our parents started to use it. It was like an easy way to attach. And everyone showed up in the valley and trying to pitch for some capital and they wanted to associate with it.
Yep, true.
I think all the Uber for freights, the first generations probably took a dirt nap. Maybe one or two are still around, but most of them took a dirt nap.
Yeah.
And then you kind of have this next generation, these digital brokers that were much better capitalized, learned from some of the mistakes, and did a phenomenal job telling a story to the venture capitalists that everyone was kind of a bozo that was existing. The incumbents were all bozos, which I don't agree with. And they raised a lot of cash, and they really did move the market. At the same time, the incumbents really stepped up their game, I think, and made a lot of tech investment. And now they have some tech debt. There's always tech debt. As soon as you write the first line of code, there's tech debt that goes with it.
Yes.
And so an incumbent may have a $100 million budget, and you look at a startup, well, they have a $100 million software budget annual, but that $100 million with an incumbent, maybe 50 or $60 million, it's going just to manage, because they have customers. They have EBITDA too, by the way. They have profit and revenue. So it goes to managing that. So there's tends to be a little bit of a disconnect there. I would say a digital broker it's probably been hijacked by the startups, but a lot of the top 100 3PLs are probably also meet the definition of a digital broker now.
Yeah, I think so too. So where I derailed this a little bit with this digital broker discussion, but it kind of drives me nuts.
It's a hot topic. You mentioned it every podcast. Like, let's just have a full-on like debate or something. Let's find someone that's got different thing. Let's just rip.
Oh, I am. I spent hours on Friday researching and trying to go through the companies, and like I'm trying to bucket. So we have traditional brokerages. We have digital freight brokerage. Then we have marketplace.
Right.
And then I can't remember what my notes said, but then, so I was researching and trying to put together, I'm going to put together a one hour podcast on the three, digital broker. So I was just checking to see if somebody was going to correct me, but I want to put together a podcast saying, okay, let's, who are these three buckets? What exactly are they? And who's, like, be real, who's duplicating whose products? who's really doing something fucking innovating and great? And who's a who? Like, you know what I'm saying? So,
yeah.
Because it's driving me nuts. I feel like everybody's popping out saying that they're a digital freight broker or they're a marketplace. Or da, 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 da. And then I try to drill down on exactly what that means. And either they're confused or they've got the wrong definition or they truly are unique. Drill down on that. So anyhow, a little bit of a rant.
We have our own definitions internally. And I guess I would say from ours, this is loose and I need to go back and read. But when I think digital broker, they can provide an instant rate quote to an algorithm.
Mm.
And then a broker tends to not be able to provide an instant rate quote immediately. And so it's very customer facing or on this how the supply side or the demand side would think about it. Mm-hmm. And then marketplaces, I think you definitely start getting into, you start to leave brokerage and then get into software more, the SaaS side. Mm-hmm. But because if you want to insert yourself in a transaction in the US, you need US brokerage authority. And so I think that even muddies it a little bit more, that restriction that you have in the US. We see software companies that are marketplaces, like Emerge comes to mind, that they have a brokerage authority, but they're really a software company.
Hmm. I always tell people that's the biggest thing that people come to me about is, am I market, Cassandra, I'm a marketplace. Oh, the third one's a load board, by the way. So we've got traditional brokerage, digital freight brokerage, marketplace, and then a load board. And then what's the difference between all four? But anyhow, so I had four, I couldn't remember. So I have clients that come to me a lot saying, Cassandra, do I need broker authority? We're just a marketplace. And you don't automatically need the broker authority unless you start to get in, unless you're not a true marketplace. Right. And I tried to dig into their operations to find out, are you really getting involved with the freight matching? Are you issuing the documents, the bill ratings? Are you getting involved or are you truly just providing a platform, algorithms, and you're stepping away? Letting the parties come together. So that's the biggest distinction between the two. But I find that those who have a marketplace, they're often dabbling in the brokerage world,
right?
Brokerage tasks. So they got to go get the authority. But it's so confusing to so many.
I agree. And I think the, and by the way, like these companies that go to market, like it's not from a legal perspective. I agree with your assessment. It's just a marketing thing also. And it's the customers and also the VCs, they've got several masters that they're trying to satisfy.
Mm-hmm. That's so true. So where else are you seeing opportunities in the industry, if anywhere? And have you come across any interesting companies that we should keep track of? And this is kind of off the cuff question. So.
Yeah, there's some really cool companies. Today, I was just looking at Parade AI. I thought they had a pretty cool. I think I've seen them pop up a few times in the last couple of weeks. I think Smart Hop's really cool. I like what they're doing. Their play is, so imagine all these carriers, there's many of them, hundreds of thousands of them that don't really have much software to operate with. And what I like about them is they're building really, really inexpensive, usable software for the carriers. And then, essentially what they do is they help those carriers, with their go-to-market. So help them do business with the brokers easier. So kind of take out the friction there. So I think that's cool.
Do you know if they help the carriers with the finance side of things, like truly understanding their operating costs?
I don't know. That'd be a question.
I'm trying to find a company that truly helps carriers understand what their operating costs are. Because boys.
Yeah, those, a lot of those. And I think that's one of the reasons that there's that low ROIC, right? Uh-huh. There's just not a lot of great tools. The tools that are out there for LTL are decades old. Old Dominion has built, a great tool. They've been rewarded well for it. The truckload side, though, I don't think, maybe one of these marketplaces or something, maybe SmartHub, I don't know. Tive's pretty cool. Tive. It's a piece of hardware.
Tive, T-I-V-E?
Yeah, they track global products. So I'm always looking at global, not just the U.S., but the nice, reliable piece of hardware at a good price that has a long battery life that can be
goes in the portably. Container?
Yeah. Yep, that's right. And smart. It's like, well, we've talked about it forever, but the battery life and cost of cell signals, really there's always been these limitations. Well, they're unique because either they're too expensive, the battery won't last, and so they're expensive. You have these reverse logistics to get into play. So to actually make one where it's like, it's disposable, or it's really easy to ship back. That's nice to see. I think they're getting rewarded well by the market.
I'm gonna check that one out.
I know there's some other great companies out there too.
So what are you planning on doing for the rest of 2020, especially since this year is unlike any year we've ever had to face?
Yeah, it's crazy. Well, I'm really excited. Hopefully I can go see, my favorite thing is to go visit customers and go.
Mine too.
Just go and learn and understand what's happening. So hopefully in 2020, that's possible. Hopefully we're able to meet in businesses again. We're really fortunate in Q2, we signed on more logos than we had in any other quarter in the company's history. So that's a lot of implementation, a lot of execution. We owe to our existing customers, it's going to be heavy investment in hardening our product and making it better.
What does that mean, hardening?
Hardening, it's a tech term. It just means like baking it more, going through and just making a lot of this. We're constantly investing in our product. We have a disproportionate amount of investment capital that goes towards making the product better. But there's always this balance of innovation plus hardening. And I think maybe last quarter I got a little too far ahead on innovation. And that's like, I'm looking at some things, I'm going, okay, let's go back and let's like really, really harden the existing product. Now you're trying to expand in new countries and new geographies and new modes of transportation. And you don't always see the vibrations the right way. So,
mean you go back and you look at your current product and you say, okay, how can we make it better?
That's
less,
right.
Less glitches or more features or.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's spend more time with customers and say, you've used this product now for 6 months or 4 years. Like, what are the enhancements? And we're always doing that. But the question is, are you spending 40% of your product and engineering resources on it? Or are you spending 70% on that? And I want to be closer to that 70% for the remainder of the year. So really going down, doubling down on that.
Like client loyalty, customer loyalty?
Yeah. Yep. And that goes into LTV. It goes in the lifetime value. It goes into net retention, churn. So you get rewarded also for it. But I just like being able to go to a conference. I'm an industry guy. And walk from one side to the other and not have people like, mother F my name. Like, yeah. It's like actually more like a good product out there. I know it's not always perfect, but we try to make it better and better every day. And so I appreciate everyone's support on that. But it's cool to be able to interact with so many people that are using something that that was created. So I want to take care of those people.
Well, we are very lucky to have you.
Thank you.
And we have learned a lot from you. Thank you for going off script today with us too.
Yeah,
we tend to learn so much more with people when we do that. So for those of you, Jet, connect with him on LinkedIn, follow him. He's doing exciting things at Project 44. And thank you. Thank you very much, Jet. Appreciate it.